This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. was once a friendly place for labor organizing. Many workers carried union cards, and we celebrate Labor Day every September to honor the power of collective action. But union density has plummeted, and North Carolina has some of the harshest laws around collective bargaining. Joining us for a closer look at that history is David Zondermann. He teaches courses in American labor history and heads the history department at NC State University. David, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Frank.
Let's talk about this because we're going to talk about the decline in support for labor unions generally. And, of course, that had been true for decades. But very recently as August, Gallup polls showed rising support, maybe at a 50-year high for labor unions. Let's start here in this moment. What accounts for the increased support in this moment for labor unions?
There's a couple different possible explanations people are talking about. I think one is, especially among younger workers, say 35 and younger, who have sort of grown up with the post-crash, post-2008 economy. A lot of them are caught up, as many people are, now working two or three part-time crummy jobs for low wages, no benefits. A lot of them are in various forms of the gig economy where they're sort of very precarious jobs and sort of cobbling things together. And some of them, I think, are beginning to, they vaguely may or may not know what a union is, but they hear if there is one and if it's possible to get a contract, they may actually get a better wage. They may be treated better with more respect. They may get a chance at benefits. So to them, union's not a dirty word. So I think it's at least one explanation is this generational shift.
I want to bring Angaza Laughinghouse into this conversation. Angaza is the founding member of the labor organization Black Workers for Justice and UE Local 150, the North Carolina Public Service Workers Union. Angaza Laughinghouse, welcome back. Good day to be here. It's been too long.
Frank.
Tell us a little bit what you see from the ground as a labor organizer, whether you feel this support for this increased support.
I think that particularly our young folks understand that the country is in a major crisis. Many of the jobs that they have absolutely no benefits, no health care, no pension, not even 401k contributions. So they are beginning to feel this heavy weight of this crisis that has been developing for some time now. Also, many of them have seen that some unions, we call them social movement unions, have taken on other issues that impact everyday working class people, such as affordable housing, universal health care, Medicare for all. As you know, the unemployed and even small business entrepreneurs don't have health care, and many of these young folks coming out of school can't find the quality of jobs they want, so they go in business or they work as contractors, and they too have no health care, no pension, no retirement. And as an on-the-ground organizer, one of the things I recognize from a group that is a part of Black Workers for Justice, which I'm a member of, Hip Hop for Justice and Our Youth, is many of them have no health insurance at all. Yeah. They are certainly pro-union. When they get into a workplace, they're ready to get rocking in terms of doing the organizing.
Well, David Zondermann, let's talk about this, because the idea that somehow social issues would be part of a union's portfolio sounds almost new, but it's not novel at all. In fact, that's what unions were. It was very much a part of union organizing back in the earliest days of unions.
Yeah, that's historically, for more than a century, literally, that has been one of the key debates in the labor movement. And it's tended to sort of ebb and flow over the decades. At some times, some and in some key unions embrace what this idea, as a concept, of what's called social unionism, that a union certainly should represent its own members, but beyond that, it represents workers writ large. And that wherever someone is being mistreated, injustice, whether that's based on your work, your class, your race, your gender, whatever, unions should be there in the fight. And to this day, there are some unions that have stay with that, take that very seriously. But in recent decades, there's also been a shift in some unions, again, not all, but some, to a much more of what's called a business union model, that our job is to just service our members, and we're all about just the contract, and to get, if some a modest adjustment in this or that benefit or whatever. And again, that's not a bad, I would argue that's not a bad thing, but it's a much more limited thing. And I think, and I would argue over time, it often hurts unions, hurts their members, and hurts the labor movement as a whole, because then it can be called a narrow special interest. And that's often a very effective way to club the unions back.
Well, and I've seen, too, that this really got more or less locked into stone or became more extreme after World War II, where what you said had been a debate, a tension in the movement, had more or less resolved itself as unions that were looking for wages and benefits.
Yeah, I think you're right. Certainly, for example, in the 50s, some of the most powerful unions, auto workers, steel workers, became known for their sort of quote-unquote great contracts, which were great for their members, but sort of left everybody else out. But I'll quickly add, the auto workers is an interesting example because at least as long as they were led by Walter Reuther up through about the early 70s, Reuther himself was a very strong proponent of the civil rights movement and actually put quite a bit of money in. If you look at all those signs from the March on Washington in 1963, they're all, not all, but a whole chunk of them were printed by the UAW and like thousands of them. So it's a complex pattern, but I think you're right. In the decade or two following the Second World War, when unions sort of hit their peak, a lot of them became much more sort of business contract oriented.
I think there's a revitalization in this period in terms of having a broader vision for what the role of unions are. When we look at the Fight for 15 trend, which was initiated by the Service Employees International Union, when we look at many unions lining up with immigrant workers in terms of challenging the Trump administration's position on building the wall and treatment of immigrants. We got to see that in this period, I think there's great opportunity. And I think the reasons that traditional unions, business unions, are beginning to see these opportunities is because what they've been doing over the last 20, 30 years just isn't working. It's not growing and broadening and deepening the trade union movement. We have now worker centers all over the United States. I know that Black Workers for Justice has joined an alliance of I think it's called the National Black Workers Center Project. It's an alliance where more and more creative sort of thinking and organizing is taking place around those issues of immigrant rights, fighting for 15, which there's been quite a few victories, and also around the question of, did I say immigration rights?
You talked a little bit about. Well, let me ask you about those things. Fighting for 15, of course, a $15 an hour wage. Let's talk about some of the tensions and how they were built into this. Racial tensions, particularly as unions took on a more business like model. What was the impact there, and how did unions become so racially divided in the peak period for union organizing?
Well, we have to take a close look at the long legacy of slavery, of Jim Crow, segregation, apartheid, and its impact. When we give certain workers certain rights, certain privileges, and other workers don't have those basic human rights, it creates a major division. It's a major contradiction, too, when you're trying to build the strength of all working class folks, and it weakens the effort to challenge the big corporate bosses. And I think, though, with the leadership, and there's a lot of young leadership and new leadership who are stepping up into the broader labor movement, which includes not only trade unions, but worker organizations, like the Immokalee workers down in Florida, like the Fight for 15. I know our union, the North Carolina Public Service Workers Union, UE Local 150, and our national union, the United Electrical Radio Machinist Workers Union, better known as UE, has joined these particular struggles, including the broader struggle. I never forget four years ago, at our national convention in Baltimore, our national union formally participated and allied with the Black Lives Matter movement. And some unions are beginning to broaden their understanding of what's really necessary for us to build a kind of union movement and revitalize the kind of union movement that we need in this particular crisis that the U.S. finds itself in.
But, you know, you talked about immigration, and there you can see where there might be a great deal of tension. Unions have been a little bit skeptical about whether or not immigration should be their cause. Workers coming to this country willing to work for less don't necessarily strengthen your bargaining position. So you can see where maybe a union is not so willing intuitively to embrace immigrant rights. Talk about the tension there, and you say things are changing. What's causing that change?
Well, many of these immigrant workers, by the way, some of them have union experiences, whether they're from the Caribbean or even Mexico, where I know our union, the United Electrical Radio Machinist Workers Union, has a relationship with some of those Mexican unions. And so when those immigrants come, many of them have some union experience. I think it's short-sightedness on the part of some union leaders and our base membership in some of the more conservative unions not to understand why immigrants, and don't forget, when these unions were founded way back in the early 1900s, 1920s and 30s, immigrants helped build these great unions that we had during that period. And they challenged FDR, as you know, to begin to make concessions with the National Labor Relations Act, the minimum wage, and a host of other legal reforms that has helped push working people forward. That's when we had about a third of all Americans who were in unions. But today, as we look at what's happening, I think, and maybe because I happen to be hanging out with some great people, such as you and others, who understand this vision of why our union, if it's going to survive, the labor movement is going to have to broaden and deepen itself in terms of relating to casual workers, unemployed workers, immigrant workers, particularly the youth. It's amazing that we haven't opened up our union halls to our youth around some of these labor questions. I know that we have, my union has, we have a union office on New Bern Avenue in Raleigh, and we open it up to all kinds of basic community organizations. And I know Black Workers for Justice has two worker centers. One is the Fruit of Labor World Cultural Center in Raleigh, and the other one is our center in Rocky Mount at 622 Clark Street. And we try to open our centers up, our workplaces up, to our youth, that we know we have a role to play in terms of sharing this sort of political education with them about why unions are important.
David Zondervan, talk about maybe the ebb and flow of the tension when with regard to immigrant workers, going back to the beginning, because, you know, as Angaza said, I mean, those unions were very much made up of immigrants in the early days, right?
Yeah. Some of them were. It's interesting that if you go back, say, a century, many of the very skilled trades, particularly in the building trades, the craft trades, they often were the most hostile to immigrants because they, again, saw them, as you were just saying, as a threat to their jobs, that they would de-skill, they'd bring in lower wages. And that's something the American labor movement wrestled with, again, for a very long time, all through the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The breakthrough comes kind of around the 1980s, 1990s. The leadership of the AFL-CIO, which is the sort of umbrella organization of most major unions in this country, sort of made that intellectual shift and realized that this sort of visceral anti-union stance was driving people into the shadows, and therefore they became even more exploited and more likely to undercut organized
immigrant
labor.
Anti-immigrant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, in fact, becoming more sympathetic, getting on the side of justice for immigrant workers, in fact, is not only the argument was it's not only the morally right thing to do, it's actually good for unions because you want to bring them in. But again, it took that sort of break. People had to kind of almost flip the switch. Like suddenly they had to realize, yes, you're right. I'm hurting myself and my union by opposing almost every immigrant worker. But it's been a long change.
Well, it's another flipped switch comes in the 70s and 80s when we see a decline both in union power and also in union acceptance and approval in the American public. And it's fascinating to think about it because that was a time when labor unions were beginning, you know, workers' rights were eroding, particularly in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan is hostile to working people. He's hostile to unions. And we can see workers giving back, the give back begin. And you would think this would increase support for unions. And on the contrary, people became more hostile to unions and found a different scapegoat.
I like to bring some clarity to that point you're raising. It wasn't the workers who gave back. Oftentimes, it's the leadership. Leadership's very important in all organizations. Leadership has to have a vision, and they have to, you know, make sure they educate their rank-and-file members. I think one reason why I'm very excited in this period is that many of these social movement unions that are developing, name one is the National Nurses Union, the other one is United Electrical Radio Machinist Workers Union, the other one is a Canadian union that UE is working closely with now called Unifor. It's a conglomeration of many unions of over 360,000 members in Canada. And what they're doing is political education. They're building what we call community unions, which are people that work in many workplaces. And this is something that they said they learned from Black Workers for Justice, since Black Workers for Justice consists of people from many different workplaces. And we don't always have unions. We have what we call workplace organizations. I think this kind of thinking is very important. And I also, on the question of immigrants, I think in terms of leadership, one of the reasons that some of the more conservative unions are afraid of immigrants, because many of them come from very radical trade union traditions. Some of our union members had a chance to participate in the World Social Forum. When we went to Brazil, we noticed they had revolutionary unions, like their Workers' Party in Brazil. We were in Venezuela. Again, we saw some very radical, revolutionary-style leadership from their trade union leaders. And we all know that COSATU in South Africa, many of those trade unionists, they laughed at our trade union movement in America because many of them were revolutionaries. They were fighting for power. They weren't just fighting for better jobs, better wages. They were fighting for political power. So oftentimes, the more traditional leaders in the U.S., they see things narrowly in terms of just electoral politics. Who's going to give us more pro-labor policy? While some of these other immigrants who've had these other political experiences, they know that what's at the heart of the trade union movement should be, what kind of power are we going to build for working people?
Well, on that note, let me ask the historian then, in this moment where we've seen unions weakened in this country for decades, and of course capital has been able to assemble all of its power unchecked without rules that check the power of capital to array itself against labor, is it too late? Is it too late to actually assemble enough power, given the weakness over these decades and the power of capital?
No, I don't think we should ever say it's too late. It is a tough struggle, and I think the struggle has to take many different forms. I'm one of these people who believes usually it's all the above, meaning I think there has to be struggle at the workplace. I think there has to be struggle in communities. I think we need to struggle to change laws. Our laws, our key labor laws, are from the 1930s and 40s, and our economy has changed drastically in some good ways and in some really bad ways. And so we're using models in not all cases, but in many cases, they're just outmoded, outdated.
That's right.
We need to change them. And I think, again, I very much agree with my brother Agonze here that some unions are waking up to this. They're beginning to realize this is not your grandfather's labor movement. This is not your grandfather's workplace. Literally, you've got to change things. But some of that change is hard to do internally, and some of it's hard to do because laws change slowly. There's a lot of opposition. So you got to work on all those levels. I mean, I'm one of these people who believes, yes, we have to change law, but that's not going to do it all. We have to work in our communities. We have to work in our workplaces. It's all the above.
Agonze, I'm going to give you 30 seconds because I know you sound optimistic.
Oh, boy. You know, I'm very optimistic. I'm glad that I'm surrounded with leaders that are optimistic. As y'all can see that recently the teachers movement, teachers and unions from Chicago to West Virginia to even North Carolina, they're coming forth. They're taking more and more militant action. They're doing strikes. And also we know that the auto industry just recently with the contract renegotiations in Ford and GM, we're having more union strikes and actions now than we've had in a long time. I have every reason to be optimistic that folks are going to want to put their fist up and fight not just for better workplace conditions, but a better society. The teachers raise up the question of health care for the children, bringing more nurses into the school. They raise the question of need for affordable housing in Chicago. All these things show that there's lots of leadership out there that has a broader vision.
And Gaza Laughing House is a founding member of the Black Workers for Justice, UE Local 150, and part of the Fruit of Labor Singing Ensemble. David Zonderman, a professor and a head of the History Department at NC State, thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks we want to thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a look at what the gig economy has to say about all of this on The State of Things. Do stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Teachers around the state have been staging regular protests for years. Minimum wage workers have been in a parallel fight to earn at least $15 an hour. Across the country, many people go to work each day for companies and institutions, and they have limited control over their careers and not making a living wage, not having health benefits. Margaret McNabb says there is another option. You can strike out on your own, freelance, get a gig. Margaret advocates for people to take their passion, skills, and experience and turn all of that into freelance jobs. But while there is the possibility of greater freedom, self-employed people are also more vulnerable. Margaret McNabb is co-founder of the Freelance League of North Carolina, and she joins me now. Margaret, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tell us about your organization, sort of this aggregation of freelancers.
Yeah, all right. So the Freelance League of North Carolina is an organization that I co-founded with Julianne Alexander 2.5 years ago. She and I are both longtime freelancers. And I've, over the 15 years of my career, I've been in and out of the freelance economy, although that's how I got started, which is a whole story unto itself. I had been watching the stats and have been fascinated with the growth of the gig economy. And, the last time that I struck out, I was just so excited about that. I said, well, I really just want to see these people. So 2.5 years ago, I threw a happy hour and 25 people showed up, and I thought that was pretty neat. So I said, okay, well, let's do it again. And so I threw one the next month and 125 people showed up, all people who identified as independent workers, as marketers, technologists, and many other things, creatives. And so I said, okay, well, we need to put a name to this and keep this work going. And pretty quickly, that community ballooned to 1,500 people plus. And that is kind of, the work that we're doing today.
Hey, well, and what is the work once they're all together? Once the happy hour is over, then what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the work is really about, it is about developing a collective identity, which happens in that room, happens in a room where you get people together and they start talking about work and they start sharing opportunities. That's a really big part of it for people who are isolated, who are working at home, and a lot of ways may not see themselves as part of a bigger context. So sometimes it's the very, very little things that make a big difference. We also do educational programming. There are very few resources out there that help people figure out how to be their own business. I learned that myself the hard way many, many, many times over. So that's been kind of a particular interest, financial literacy, how to brand and get more business, how to develop the skills to be your own HR department, your own CFO, all of that kind of stuff.
When you do all of that, I mean, it's interesting to think about people with a collective identity who are all essentially working for themselves. The upside, of course, is that you've got a lot more freedom about, how to come and go. You're in control. Mm-hmm. The downside is, I would say, precarity. On the one hand, you're on your own, so you may or may not have a job or a gig the next day. Mm-hmm. But the other side is just sort of being taken advantage of, not having any kind of leverage in the work. Somebody's paying you, and that paymaster is somebody that you have to, they are creating conditions for you to work, and you don't have much say in that. How do you kind of cope with that, having some leverage and some say in your work when it comes to the paymaster?
Yeah, I mean, those are very hard-won lessons. Those are some of the, it comes with experience, being able to advocate for what you're worth at the very beginning, how to, really understand what you're getting into, the terms of the agreements that you're signing. Which is, again, why it is, you know, the smallest thing of just getting folks together so that they can share that kind of information. Because it's true, like, you don't have that, you know, you really don't have any leverage in those situations, other than if you are, so the kind of work that I do is marketing work and, you know, the developers and creative folks, really the only leverage you have is to say, okay, I'm done working. And depending on where you're at in the course of a project, that's a pretty significant, you know, and good position to be in if you have the encouragement or the guts to make that call.
Right. Right. Well, the other thing is again the leverage. I mean, if the you know, somebody you're working for hands you an agreement and you don't like it, if you're in a position because you're superior at what you do and they can't find anybody else, you can get some changes.
That's right.
If you're a dime a dozen, sign it or you go broke, right?
Yeah, sign it or, I mean, that's absolutely true.
And is there any advantage, and this is kind of the interesting thing, is there any advantage in sort of creating a collective like this? Because you can't, I mean, if you're in marketing and somebody else is driving a taxi, you've got different employers. So being in a collective in that sense may not help you as much. But I suppose hearing the experiences of other people could be useful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Mentorship. Like, again, there is there are so few resources. There are so few places that you can go or ways that you can connect with other people. That's, I mean, that's really the biggest challenge is if you're totally isolated, then you absolutely have even less power than you do if you're loosely associated with other people.
And give us a sense of who makes up this aggregation. Now, I'm sure it's a widely diverse group, so give us a sense of who makes up the gig economy these days.
Yeah, I mean, that's the gig economy, even that term is, right. It's just so broad. You know, it's nearly the same as, you know, who's the business community.
Right.
I mean, it's restaurants and Fortune 500 companies. So it's, you know, same kind of idea applies. The gig economy is the folks that we oftentimes think about and associate, folks who are driving for Lyft and Uber, and then, you know, professional freelancers, people who you know, like the folks who are in my community, who are 40% of the gig economy, which is pretty significant when you think about the association that we make with one, but it's really, you know, a much larger group and very complex issue because it is everybody. When we're talking about who are the individual faces that make up the gig economy, it is every generation. There is, you know, I think a lot of times people think about gig work as being a youth movement or, you know, but that's not necessarily the case.
No, a lot of retired folks or people who leave early because they've maybe reached the peak in their career, right? They're CEOs and they're 45 and they've done it all. But they've got a lot of knowledge, which they can sell on the market, right?
Absolutely. Or they've got health issues or they've got other reasons that make the inflexibility of the traditional workforce a place where they really can't create opportunity for themselves. Those aren't viable viable options. They have aged out of the market, and it's harder to get a job or even consideration for those roles. But like you just said, they have expertise that's very valuable, and if they can repackage that, then they can make some pretty significant money.
And we should probably make a distinction here because, again, we've got this broad, you know, this category of gig economy and gig workers, but there is a difference between a freelancer who's working in an industry and has expertise and somebody working for a corporation like Uber, which is a little more like sharecropping in a way. Mm-hmm. You take all the responsibility for yourself. We're not going to feed you or clothe you anymore, but we will profit from your labor. That's a far different kind of gigging than freelancing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that it's the language around the gig economy. We took freelancers, independent workers, consultants, you know, side hustlers. I mean, they're solopreneurs. I mean, I think that, you know, that it begs the question, are these people entrepreneurs or are they exploited workers? You know, and the language just does not serve this community very well.
And the law in some ways, because it became, I mean, corporations began to realize, particularly in the 80s, that if they would just lay off all their workers who were under contract and had certain benefits and certain work conditions that were guaranteed, we'll just break that by firing you all, and then we'll hire you back mm-hmm. as a freelancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
it took a lot of work to get both the tax code to change and some other laws. Talk about how that has changed, or has it, for workers to get back some of the rights that they lost as freelancers. What's the landscape these days?
Boy, I think the landscape is still, it's still kind of the Wild West. There is, some states are more advanced than others. So I think about New York City, in fact, and Mayor de Blasio's office and some of the work that they've done to support independent workers and some of the legislation that they passed, the Freelance Isn't Free Act, which was passed in 2007, I believe, 2008.
And what does that do? Give us a sense of
that basically is a policy that enforces employers. They have to pay within 30 days. Because so what you see with, so like, earlier this year, there's a big hubbub around some of the policies. CNN, I'll use them as an example, mm-hmm. Who has a net 90 policy. Right. So again, I work now and then I'll get paid in late Q1 of 2020. Well, what the heck kind of sense does that make? Right. Who's going to wait? What other business is going to wait 90 days?
Because my landlord has a net 30.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And my car loan is a net 30.
Yeah, what other,
and my grocery
and
store
reality?
Is a net every week. Yeah.
That's right, that's yeah. right. So, the city of New York there, and that was also passed with the Freelancers Union, with support from the Freelancers Union really driving that legislation.
California, I know, law, what was it, AB5, that mm-hmm. makes it harder for companies to label a person a freelance worker. Can you explain mm-hmm. how that works and sort of whose benefit that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that case, that was really, it was really about the big car services that we think about, Lyft and Uber. It's about tax dollars. Mm-hmm. It's always, you'd be a little bit skeptical about who those policies are really serving or what that's really all about. But that's, again, where the language around the gig economy around freelancers gets a little bit dangerous, right? Because then those folks who are making a good living as a writer for, 10, 15 different publications, then all of a sudden they're out of work. Right. Or, that policy doesn't work for them. So... So the question is, okay, so those folks, we can't, they're freelance writing, so that's, that's a goner. Okay, so are there all of a sudden going to be jobs at all these media organizations to fill in the gaps? Or what happens? So that's, again, where this blanket idea of what the gig economy is really complicated.
Well, and as you said many times, the labeling, what we're going to call you. A part of what you do at the Freelance League of North Carolina is to educate members about being a freelance worker. What are some of the biggest struggles? I mean, what do they come to you with and talk about in terms of their needs?
A lot of it is where do I find work? It's about how do I price myself? Those are always conversations I love having because of the conversations that people aren't having. People aren't talking about money. So let's surface those. Let's talk about them. And in a happy hour setting or elsewhere, health insurance always comes up. Healthcare is a huge challenge for this community, as it is for seemingly everybody. But I oftentimes have folks say, you should start. Like, no, that's not me.
You could start your own business.
Yeah, I mean, my interest, and I think our intent in starting, my plate is completely full with the work that I do. But I think that it's very important to raise visibility for this community that is really overlooked in our conversations about economic development, about entrepreneurship, about really just about anything, overlooked right. by the freelancers themselves or the independents. I have these incredible moments with people where I say, oh, what do you do? And I tell them, and then these moments where people are like, but I think I'm one of your people. And I said, well, you probably are. But so often they don't know that they're part of a much, much, much bigger movement. And that to me is really exciting, because what we also know about these folks is that freelancers are 18% more politically active than non-freelancers. And that's really exciting to me.
Well, they should get better benefits then.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you about this. Somebody is obviously there's this allure, this sense of freedom. I'm out from under, the corporate structure. So clearly there are benefits to being a freelance. And clearly the vision from your cubicle mm-hmm. is quite rosy. Mm-hmm. What do you advise people who are about to take the leap? What should you know if you're about to leave some kind of corporate structure to go it on your own? What do I need to know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's, taking the leap sounds very attractive and exciting and all that. And it's, there are many, many reasons why people choose and opt for the flexibility of independent work, right? I think flexibility, sometimes when we think about that, it's like, oh, I want to spend more days on the beach. I want to be able to, work in my gym shorts. And that's great, believe yeah. me. But that's really about being able to flex for being, for health issues, for example, yeah. or if you are a new parent, or for whatever reason the traditional workforce doesn't work. So I think knowing, first of all, what is the problem that you're trying to solve yeah. when you are taking the leap, not just, this seems like an exciting alternate reality, because I don't think there's not a better choice. I'm not saying that freelance is absolutely the best thing for everybody, or that a traditional job is best for everybody. But I do think that having a business mindset, and having conversations with other people who have already gone down this path is so important. So you understand what to anticipate in terms of taxes, what you should know about how to pursue, healthcare in whatever possible way that you can. There's really the best way to learn about that is find out what strategies other people have used. And then also, in terms of how you price yourself, oftentimes people will underprice themselves when they first take the leap. So, yeah.
Those are all good things. Margaret mm-hmm. McNabb is the co-founder of the Freelance League of North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about her and her organization at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.